Bible word, reading the Bible, Bible word.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Bible Worm. We're like an earworm, but for your soul. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and Pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm joined this and every week by my friend and colleague, Dr. Amy Robertson, Biblical Scholar and Executive Director of Congregation Beit HaVerim, a synagogue in Atlanta. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian. This week, we continue our narrative lectionary series with Mark 10:32-52, the third and final time Jesus predicts his death and resurrection, the request of James and John to sit at Jesus' right and left hand when he comes in glory, and the story of a blind man named Bartimaeus who asks Jesus for mercy. We talk about the human struggle to imagine power structures different from those of the empire, Jesus' invitation to the disciples to share in his suffering, if not in his glory, and the need to discern when to cry out for mercy and when to fall in line without drawing attention to ourselves. Thanks for joining us.
What's up, Bobby?
Hey, Amy. Remember that time we accidentally did two Bible worms in 1 week?
Yeah.
The Ash Wednesday Bible worm that came out on Ash Monday.
That was a fun accident, Ash Monday.
Yeah. So anyway. Accident.
Yeah.
So we're back now after having done a bonus episode that we didn't mean to do.
But it's a good one. You should listen to it.
Yeah, the one on Mark 9:30-37, episode 27. That one is worth your time. If you did not listen to it, you should go back and
go back and listen. It's like a bonus episode.
Today we are in Mark chapter 10:32-52.
We sure are.
We're in this little section that started with the double healing of the blind man in Mark chapter 8:22, and we're still in that little section in the middle. Jesus has predicted his death and resurrection twice already, and here we're just about to get the third one. Mm-hmm. I am reading in the Common English Bible. Jesus and his disciples were on the road going up to Jerusalem with Jesus in the lead. The disciples were amazed while the others following behind were afraid. Taking the 12 aside again, he told them what was about to happen to him. Look, he said, we're going up to Jerusalem. The human one, or the Son of Man, will be handed over to the chief priests and the legal experts. They will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles. They will ridicule him, spit on him, torture him, and kill him. After 3 days, he will rise up. So this is the third prediction that Jesus has given of what's going to happen to him when they get to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that? This version of that prediction?
I mean, it's a little more fleshed out.
Yeah.
I think they've been sort of increasingly fleshed out, but like there's some pretty I mean, they've all been disturbing, but there's some pretty disturbing detail in this, just in terms of, I mean, not just that he'll be killed. I mean, a lot of people are killed in political thing. It's not that's not a big deal.
Right.
But the intentional degradation that he's predicting before he's killed.
Yeah. So in my translation, ridicule, spit on him, torture him. That part is what you're thinking about?
Yes, that's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. So there's a shaming that happens as not just an execution, but the shaming that precedes it. I was struck by this line. So Jesus is like striding out in front of the group, right? They're going up the road and Jesus is in the lead. And then it says the disciples were amazed while the others following behind were afraid. I'm just interested in that kind of combination of amazedness and afraidness. Any thoughts about that?
Thoughts and questions. So in the NRSV, it's not clear who is amazed and who is afraid.
Yeah.
So in the NRSV, it says, Jesus was walking ahead of them. They were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. And so I actually wondered, like, is this like a parallelism? Like, they are the same as those who followed?
So like everyone followed.
Yeah, so
the
like
disciples and other followers are both amazed and afraid at the same time.
Yeah. Or are we talking about two different groups, which is clearly what your translation says we're talking about.
You know, one of the commentaries I was reading was suggesting that trying to parse out exactly like who's afraid and who's amazed probably is not a very useful thing to do, and that maybe it's better to read it like you were reading it, which is just to say the disciples and all those following, they're amazed, they're afraid, and they're still following along.
I'm really interested in the overlap of those categories of experience, of what it is to be amazed and what it is to be afraid and what it is to be in awe. And, you know, in Hebrew, there is one word that can mean awesome and fearful, like full of awe, full of fear, right? In English, we don't tend to think of those things as overlapping quite so much, but they really are right up next to each other, you know? They're right up next to each other. And I like that. And I think that you can feel both the positive side and the scary side at the same time.
I mean, this is a wonderful and fearful thing that is happening. And Jesus keeps saying these kind of amazing things about resurrection from the dead and these kind of horrifying things about being executed by the Gentiles, by the Romans. So like, to me, all of that seems appropriate, like all kind of one piece, like this amazing,
very valid feelings. Yes,
yeah,
all
this
the
amazing
feelings.
Shocking thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And especially given that what's being described to the people is really beyond human comprehension at that point. So it would make sense that it is both scary and amazing. You know, it's not like they've seen this before and have some category in their minds for understanding, like, oh, yeah, sure, this is, you know, it's one of those situations where the Messiah is going to be tortured and killed and then rise again.
Yeah.
You know, it's this is something new and big.
So they're amazed and afraid actually before Jesus then. So Jesus is like, oh, I see you're amazed and afraid.
Before Jesus goes on with
the I see details. You're amazed and afraid. Like, let me tell you this other thing that's going to freak you out even more. And he gives them that more specific.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because this is the third time that Jesus has explained what's going to happen to him. And so, you know, the first time was back in chapter 8.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first thing that happens is...
And Peter said, stop saying that.
Yeah, and get behind me, Satan.
Right,
yeah.
Jesus
and then
didn't
the
like that.
Second time, Jesus predicts his death is in 9:30. And then the next thing that happens is the disciples are arguing about who's the greatest.
Right, they seem to ignore what he has said.
Yeah, they
the
just
second
can't.
Time. They don't comment on it at all.
And so then we get it again here, and Jesus tells them again, here's what's going to happen. And, you know, I mean... One way of thinking about it is it's just like, it's such a shocking thing that they don't know how to process it.
I mean, that is, I think that's exactly right.
So they're just in denial, not because they're obtuse, but just because it's like, like there is no way to comprehend it.
Okay, the next question from, or the next statement from James and John is among my favorite things. I just love it.
Yeah. So this time what we get is Jesus says, hey, y'all, I'm going to be ridiculed, spit on, tortured, and killed. And after 3 days, rise up. And so then we get this little narrative that starts in 35. James and John, Zebedee's sons, came to Jesus and said, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask.
Can you just stop? Can we just stop? Like,
yeah, go ahead.
So last year, my kids were trying to get me to agree to do a YouTube challenge that was called Can't Say No for 24 hours, wherein I could not say no to anything they asked of me for 24 hours. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? Do you think I've lost my mind? Of course I'm not doing that challenge. They were like, we'll earn it. We'll do lots of chores. No way I'm not doing that. But that this would follow right after Jesus is talking about the depth of his suffering and ridicule.
Yeah.
And they're like, we would like you to do whatever we want you to do, okay?
Yeah.
Like, let's play a game. I just...
Yeah.
I love it. And I love it. It's so funny.
And the way it is in the narrative, it's like it's just part of the same conversation. It's not like any time has passed. It's
no.
Like, Jesus said this thing, and then the next thing they say is, hey, do whatever we ask you.
I'm like, what, did they hear what he said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, you may continue the reading now.
So Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? They said, allow one of us to sit on your right and the other on your left when you enter your glory. Jesus replied, you don't know what you're asking. Can you drink the cup I drink or receive the baptism I receive? We can, they answered. Jesus said, you will drink the cup I drink and receive the baptism I receive, but to sit at my right or left hand isn't mine to give. It belongs to those for whom it has been prepared. Okay, so what they're asking Jesus to do is when he's seated on the judgment throne, I take as the image there, one wants to be on his right hand and the other on his left hand, like joining him in power and capacity to judge over the nations.
I know I give Jesus a hard time sometimes for being impatient with the disciples. His response has a lot of grace in it, at least in the beginning. Like, okay, what do you want me to do?
Yeah.
You know, instead of saying like, seriously?
Jesus says, you know, and he says, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, but he gives them the option, like, can you drink? Like, do you think you can drink the cup or receive the baptism? Those are interesting images, that drink the cup and receive the baptism. Jesus talks about in the Garden in Gethsemane in Mark 14, right the night before Jesus is crucified, he's praying, take this cup of suffering away from me. So Mark is using cup that way to imply suffering, maybe suffering on behalf of others. Baptism also has that imagery of like passing through waters, and like, you know, there's that imagery in Isaiah 43 where the waters are roaring around, and like there is some danger also connoted there. But these two images, the cup and the baptism, also have sacramental connotations in the Christian context, the Lord's Supper and the sacrament of baptism. So it's kind of interesting that these two things that are like a little bit dangerous, a little bit threatening, a little bit ambiguous, like do I want this or do I not, become like the two kind of central aspects of Christian liturgical practice or ritual practice, is remembering the cup and the baptism.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
And so when he says, can you drink this cup or can you join me in my baptism? In that sense, like all Christians are kind of asked, like when you take communion, when you are baptized, you're sort of saying, yes, I can do those things, which means participating in some way in Jesus's suffering, as well as in the redemption that comes from Jesus's suffering. So it has both of those kind of sides to it.
Yeah, I think I read those more broadly, still in line with what you're saying, but just as sort of like as symbols of fate. Like, do you accept the fate that I have?
Yeah.
And they're like, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we got it.
We totally do. Totally do.
No problem.
We're totally listening and we totally do.
Which is, I mean, often like just, you know, when you think about contemporary Christian practice and, you know, Christians, like in my church, we take communion every week and like, we're like, yeah, no problem. We can do this thing. And we don't always think through like what that actually means or what that actually involves. So this kind of like the disciples kind of nonchalantly saying, yeah, no problem. Like that's kind of true to my own experience of what many of us do. Now this imagery of, can we sit on your right and left hand? Any thoughts about that particular request?
My association with the image of sort of sitting at the right hand and the left is sort of like with angels sitting around God.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like creating this divine council in some way.
Yeah.
So I just thought of it in that general sense. Is that how you're thinking of it?
I think that's right. It's position. They want to be in a position of power relative to Jesus's power. So they're thinking in terms of hierarchies and who's like, who is adjacent to power, both like physically and also metaphorically. But Mark's Jesus is not having that, like, at all.
No, Mark's Jesus says, well, can you take the suffering that comes with that? And they're like, yeah. And then Jesus says, okay, you can have the suffering, but not actually the prize.
That's so brutal. But too late now.
And too late, you agreed.
Yeah.
No backsies. Yeah.
Yeah, no backsies. Yeah.
What do you think this, it is for those for whom it has been prepared?
Yeah.
In verse 40, for whom has it been prepared to sit at the right and left hand of Jesus in his glory?
I don't know. And I'm not sure that there's much more that you can say about that. Like,
yeah,
it has been prepared. Presumably the passive there is like a divine passive, like God has prepared it. Maybe the fates have prepared it.
Right. I mean, I think I read a lot of like the fates into this passage, I guess, because I associate your cup with your fate, probably because it comes from, you know, this stuff. And anyway, but yeah, it has been prepared, which just sort of reminds me again of like, Jesus is not driving this train.
Yeah.
There is a pre-existing script of how this is going to go. And Jesus knows what it is. And he keeps telling people what it is. But they are acting out a drama that has already been written.
So then we get this notice that, so these are two of the 12 who are asking Jesus to be right and left hand. Then in verse 41, we get the other 10 disciples. So now when the other 10 disciples heard about this, they became angry with James and John. Jesus called them over and said, you know that the ones who are considered the rulers by the Gentiles show off their authority over them, and their high-ranking officials order them around. But that's not the way it will be with you. Whoever wants to be great among you will be your servant. Whoever wants to be first among you will be the slave of all. For the human one, or the Son of Man, didn't come to be served, but rather to serve, and to give his life to liberate many people. So here we get another statement that's just kind of like the one we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Another statement that's really close to 9:35. Whoever wants to be first must be last and servant of all. Here he frames it in terms of the way that the Gentiles rule over people, which I'm assuming is a reference to the way the Romans conduct themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the Romans function in terms of hierarchies. The way that their high-ranking officials show power is by ordering people around. And so the way that the Christian community is supposed to function is being contrasted to this like imperial rule.
Right.
Any thoughts and I about think, that?
I mean, I just think it can be a really helpful thing, especially if you're trying to get a new idea across and it's not quite landing with your people, as it's not here, to be able to name, like, look, I see the soup you've been cooked in. Like, this is the environment you're in. And to be able to name, like, I know that this is normal for you. This is what you see. Yeah. And what I'm saying is, it is different.
I like that a lot. I never heard that expression. This is the soup you've been cooked in. But
I think I made it up.
This is the water that you are swimming in or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's an insight from post-colonial theory that, you know, people who are dominated by the empire, the only ways that they eventually can imagine power relations is based on the power relations of the empire. And it takes a real act of imagination in the most like productive sense of the word imagination to think of any other way of organizing life.
Yeah.
And so that seems to be kind of what's happening here, is the disciples have been so shaped by the Roman authority structures, hierarchical structures, that when they try to imagine the kingdom of God, they just see it as like a reproduction of Roman authority. And Jesus is saying, no, it's a whole different kind of deal. And so you got to get that model, the one that you've been cooked in.
I was going to say, I think maybe the swimming one is a little less. Maybe my model's, my phrase is a little aggressive.
Like, it is a little aggressive. Yeah. Some people suggest that the background of this text is the servant song in Isaiah 52:13-53:12,
mm-hmm.
where the suffering servant is the one who is ridiculed and spit on and all of that kind of thing. And that somehow that ends up being liberative for the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so not everybody agrees with that interpretation, but one way of understanding what Jesus is saying is you need to be a servant like the suffering servant of Isaiah 52:3. Mm-hmm. That's the model that he has in mind, kind of a vicarious suffering on behalf of others.
I was going to say whether or not he has Isaiah in mind in particularly, but Mark really likes to reach back into the Hebrew Bible, doesn't he?
He does. And Isaiah in particular, I think, is informative for Mark. Yeah. So the last bit there in the CEB, to give his life to liberate many people.
Mm-hmm.
The NRSV, to give his life a ransom for many.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wrote next to it in my Bible, that's new.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I had been, or generally have, thought about Jesus's death being redemptive or salvific for the community in terms of the sacrificial cult at the temple, right? Which is not a ransom.
Right.
So, I mean, ransom is like the paying of a debt, right?
Yeah. That is connected to debt slavery. So paying for, you know, someone who has been sold into captivity because they were not able to pay their own debts. So paying their debt can be a way of releasing them from that captivity. So those, that kind of, I think that's where the CEB gets a liberation, to liberate many people.
No, I see where they got liberation from.
Yeah.
I mean, just in terms of like, you know, the like special victims unit episodes where people are like kidnapped and there's ransom notes and you know, that kind of, that's my extensive knowledge of
the ransoms
semantic field of ransom, the word ransom is
and then the question is, well, like, who's enslaving them, to which the answer could be sin, or the answer could be death.
Could it be like a Satan kind of figure?
Absolutely,
because I wrote in my Bible, ask Bobby about Satan.
No, I think it absolutely could be that somehow when we commit sin, like, Satan gets the rights over us in some way. And so that, like, Satan holds us captive. Mm. And so one has to pay off Satan in order to get to earn people's freedom back for them. So Jesus's death does that. So to me, like, one way to deal with this is just to say, well, we don't know exactly what it means to pay the ransom.
Yeah.
But what it really ultimately means is Jesus gave his life to set people free from sin and death. All right. So bringing this section that has extended from 8:22 to 10:52 to a close.
Yes.
We get the story of a second blind man. You remember, of course, that we started this section with this double healing of the blind man. The man
was blind.
We saw
the trees.
Healed him, and he said, I can see now, but people look like trees.
Yeah.
Jesus heals him again, and he's like, okay, now I can see.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the other story that Mark tells about a blind man, and it comes at the close. So these two stories together bracket these three.
The second section of
Mark,
right?
Yeah, and that second section includes those three predictions of Jesus' mm-hmm. death, and then the three like disciples getting it wrong, and then here's the second blind man. So in verse 46, Jesus and his followers came into Jericho. As Jesus was leaving Jericho together with his disciples and a sizable crowd, a blind beggar named Bartimaeus, Timaeus' son, was sitting beside the road. When he heard that Jesus of Nazareth was there, he began to shout, Jesus, son of David, show me mercy. Many scolded him, telling him to be quiet, but he shouted even louder, Son of David, show me mercy. Jesus stopped and said, call him forward. They called the blind man, be encouraged, get up, he's calling you. Throwing his coat to the side, he jumped up and came to Jesus. Jesus asked him, what do you want me to do for you? The blind man said, teacher, I want to see. Jesus said, go, your faith has healed you. At once he was able to see, and he began to follow Jesus on the way. So this guy is, so he's blind, he's sitting beside the road, and he hears that Jesus is there, and he shouts, show me mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people scold him, and he shouts again, show me mercy. So I'm really curious, like, why do you think the people scold him?
Okay, so in my own imagination, the folks who are there may not have encountered Jesus before.
Yeah. Because we're down in
Judea
now. Yeah,
they're pretty far. Yeah, they're pretty far from where they were.
Gospel. Yeah.
But they've heard about him. You know, they've heard that he's this incredible person, healer, leader, Messiah, whatever. And so it seems kind of like the word that comes to my mind is like chutzpahdik.
Yeah.
Like really, it takes a lot of audacity to call out to this powerful leader, me, like, pay attention to me. Yeah. I have a need.
Yeah.
And there's this sense that like there's a sense that like that's improper.
Yeah.
That's not how we communicate to our leaders. And you're like a lowly beggar. No, you don't get to decide what Jesus does.
Yeah.
Why do you think they tell him to be quiet?
No, I really like both of those. I was reading this last night with Mercy Church, with my homeless community, and they were sort of saying like, yeah, this is the way it is. Like, this guy is poor and blind and insignificant, and of course people are telling him to shut up. Like, people are annoyed by people like him, and who my community relates to him, right? And so they're saying like, this is just like, people always tell people like Bartimaeus to be quiet. And so for them, it was really helpful that mm-hmm. Jesus like pauses, goes against the will of the crowd mm-hmm. and says like, no, I want to talk to that guy who keeps shouting at me that you keep telling to shut up. A little bit in the same way that when Jesus pauses to talk to the woman with the flow of blood
mm-hmm.
while he's following Jairus, the synagogue leader, mm-hmm. that pausing to talk to someone who doesn't have any status.
And someone who is pretty insistent upon, you know, like, has the whatever to, you know, to call out again, to call out twice, to reach out and touch Jesus's cloak uninvited, to, you know, to take their healing almost upon themselves and say, like, no, I am actually a priority here.
So you could imagine that, like, the way that, you know, a beggar is supposed to behave is to sit mm-hmm. quietly and meekly until someone deigns to drop something into their cup. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, we were just talking about sort of the water that we're swimming in or the soup that we're cooked in or whatever. And I think it is really easy for folks in society who don't have much power for whatever reason to also internalize the idea that they shouldn't have power and they don't deserve to be able to take up more space.
Yeah.
And so it's profound.
Yeah.
that both the woman with the flow of blood and Bartimaeus.
Yeah.
I wish that woman had a name. That's such an unfortunate moniker.
It really is.
But that Bartimaeus will really, you know, stand on his own strength and say, no, I am worthy of healing.
So what he calls twice to Jesus is, show me mercy. Show me mercy.
The word mercy strikes me.
Yeah.
I mean, the word mercy to me, I guess I so often think of mercy in contradistinction to judgment.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't assume that there had been judgment. So I guess maybe that's part of why mercy strikes me. It's just that it seems, it's unexpected to me.
Yeah, so I agree with you on mercy. So that, like, show me mercy, like, it's putting yourself, like, entrusting yourself to the graciousness of another person, that mm-hmm. they're going to value you enough to act kindly toward you, even though maybe they don't have any real obvious reason or obligation
right,
to do
they're not required
it.
To.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that I notice here is, so if you compare this to the story we just read about the disciples came to Jesus and said, we want you to do something for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they wanted him to do was, like, give them something that they didn't deserve, right?
Yep.
And here Bartimaeus says, show me mercy, because I believe you are merciful. And Jesus then says, what do you want me to do for you?
Right. It's pretty much the same question that he had asked of the disciples in response to their slightly more brazen introduction.
Yeah. But they had come to Jesus and said, do for us whatever we ask.
Yeah.
So like, so they would.
It's really different.
When he's saying, what do you want me to do for you? It's because they have demanded a thing of him. Yeah.
Yes.
And here Bartimaeus says, show me mercy. And Jesus says the same words. You're exactly right. What do you want me to do for you? But here it's an invitation to, like, well, what does mercy look like for you?
Right. What does that look like
for you? So instead of demanding something and being about power, the way Bartimaeus gets Jesus's favor is by acknowledging that he's the son of David, whatever that means, and asking to show me mercy, which is what we know Jesus does. Yeah. So he says, I want to see. And then this healing, like, is so simple, right?
Yeah. He just says, okay.
Yep. Go. Your faith has healed you.
Yeah.
When you contrast that to the double healing of the blind man where this section began, where Jesus
really
struggled.
He had to, like, spit in his eyes and it didn't work. And I mean, it was striking to me that there was no request from Jesus or no instructions to, like, go away and don't tell anybody or, you know, I feel like usually it hasn't usually been the case that the person who's healed is then even really particularly invited to just follow along.
Well, it's interesting because what Jesus says is go.
That's true.
Which is,
this is just where he went.
It's not as explicit as he said with, like, the guy with the demon, with the legion of demons, where he said, go back to your hometown and, like, don't come with me.
Yeah.
Here it's go, which I think could be understood as, like,
you're right.
Go away. Or it could be understood as, like, previously, this guy's been sitting beside the road, and now Jesus is saying, like, get on the road.
Yeah.
And so I've gone back and forth about whether the Jesus has said, go away, and the man says, I don't care if you tell me to go away, I'm coming with you. Or if Jesus has said, like, get on the road, and the guy says, okay, I'm on the road with you. Like, whether there's a contrast there or not.
Do you think, you know, when we read the first story of the double healing, I always want to say double helix. When we read the first story of the double healing, you pointed out that it sort of, you know, metaphorically held the idea that the disciples got it but didn't get it.
Yeah.
Right? So do you think with this more clear healing at the end, they get it?
So the way that I have read this is Bartimaeus gets it.
Mm-hmm.
Bartimaeus says, hey, Jesus, you're the one that can show me mercy. So he already has kind of seen, and then when Jesus heals him, he follows Jesus on the way. There's not a lot of talking. There's not a lot of, like, can I, you know, be the greatest? It's just he follows on the way. And so the way I have thought about that is, you know, Bartimaeus is kind of a model of what one is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. One is supposed to ask Jesus to show us mercy. Then you're supposed to follow. Where Jesus goes, you're going to go there. How do you read that?
I'm going to tell you the thought I just had, and maybe it answers a question, and maybe it doesn't. But last time, I think it was last time, we were reading part, I guess they were, maybe it was when they were arguing about who was the greatest, and Jesus took the child and put the child in the group and said, you know, you have to, whoever welcomes a child welcomes me. And you and I had a whole conversation about how it's really great to be welcoming, but also like that if you're the child in this story, the story is not really about you, right? Yeah. The story is not about the person who doesn't have power. The story is about the people who do have power and how they should use it. And in some ways, I feel like Bartimaeus is the person who doesn't have power. You know, like my critique when we read that last story was the story is written for the people in power and not for other people. And I feel like this is a story. This is a story for people who don't have a lot of power, sort of modeling how we should interact with Jesus in this model, right? This is how we should interact with Jesus in the Christian model. It's just really interesting because, you know, you say like, we should all be Bartimaeus, and we should. And we should all be the disciples sitting in the circle welcoming the child. You know what I mean? Like, it's sort of like, we should identify with both the powerful and the powerless in these stories.
So I think that the last couple of comments have kind of started to shift us toward our usual closing question, which is, when you read this as a modern person and the communities that you're connected to, what do you think we might take away for the living of our life today?
I'm interested in this question of when we wait patiently and be mindful that we're not taking up too much space and create space for other people.
Yeah.
And when we need to cry out repeatedly.
Yeah.
Even when people tell us to stop it
and
say, no, it's my turn. It is rightfully my turn to ask for what I need.
That's good.
The Hebrew word anava means humility, and it's, you know, a character trait that we all work on, but it doesn't mean humility like make yourself small. It means humility like balance, like right size yourself and figure out when you're taking up too much space and when you're not taking up enough space. And so that's what this overall section of text makes me think of, like the disciples who are looking for how they can maximize their power, even among the already prominent disciples who are the most powerful disciples and who will be at the right and the left. And then Bartimaeus, who really does need to speak for himself because no one else is going to look out for him.
Yeah.
But it's hard because, I mean, I don't have that much power or that little power.
Yeah.
You know? I'm somewhere in the middle, somewhere in that gray area. So that's the question that this text raises for me. What about you? What do you pull from this text?
The part of this text that really is striking to me is the request from James and John, having just heard once again that Jesus is going to suffer and die, and yet they're still seeking for their own advantage and their own power. And the contrast that Jesus makes between this is the way the empire works, where we're supposed to like seek our own power. We're supposed to try to angle for the top. They've pulled Jesus aside from the other 10. And so, like you're saying, even within the little group of insiders, they're still trying to work.
Angle
like,
above, right? Yeah. Shoulder their way up higher.
That's exactly it. And Jesus is calling them out on that and saying, look, this is the way the empire works. Like you can look and see. This is the way Rome works. Like, this is the way that American society works. Like, you gotta step on other people in order to get yourself closer to the position of power. And Jesus really is here again trying to get people to see, like, this is not the structure of the way that the people of God are supposed to conduct themselves. This is replicating the empire. And the community of God is supposed to be a community of people putting themselves at the in the position to lift up other people who are disadvantaged compared to them. But I'm also struck by Bartimaeus, who, like you say, he does call out. He does know when to seek mercy. And to me, that request, like, show me mercy, is such a different request than give me power. Right.
Or, we want you to do what we want.
Yeah.
Can you agree to that before we tell you
do
what
whatever
it is?
I want.
Yeah, right.
And so I think even for people who are in a position of power, if your approach to Jesus is to say, show me mercy, like to me, that's a great starting place because it suggests that you actually realize you need someone to treat you the way, like not based on like what you think you deserve, but just to treat you based on the fact that Jesus is a merciful person.
Mm-hmm.
Bartimaeus also, when he is healed, he gets in line and he follows. He's not trying to be right next to Jesus. He's not trying to be second or third in command.
That's right.
He just takes up a position in the back, like along, mm-hmm. you know, along with the others.
Yeah.
And so the contrast between him and James and John, like, I think that's a useful thing to think about too. You know, for those of us who are used to being in the front of the line, taking up a position somewhere in, you know, just not anywhere special, but just being part of the crowd that is following might be a good place for us to be.
Yeah.
So next week in the narrative lectionary, we're going to skip chapter 11 for the time being, because that's the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, which we're going to come back to on Holy Week. So we're headed into Mark chapter 12 next week, the parable of the wicked tenants and the question of whether one ought to pay taxes to the government.
Okay, good. I look forward to that.
Yeah, so we'll be in chapter 12, 1 through 17.
Learning about taxes.
Learning about taxes.
Well, we will find out in our next podcast whether you actually need to pay them.
I'm sure that I do. It never goes well for me. All right.
Always a pleasure.
Indeed. I'll see you next week.
See you next week. Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Bible Worm. This week's theme song was sung by our friends from Mercy Community Church of Little Rock. If you'd like to be featured on Bible Worm, just record yourself or your group singing our theme song and email it to us at BibleWormPodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back next week to discuss Mark 12, 1 through 17, the parable of the wicked tenants and the question about paying taxes to Caesar. We'll see you then.